Hey everyone, Randy Schuler of the Beauty Brains here with an encore presentation of one of the most important yet least listened to episodes in our entire catalog. This is a show on regulations in the beauty industry, and the reason this is so important is that so many people believe this myth that the beauty industry is unregulated, and the more people who believe that, the more likely there are to be additional government regulations, which, in its extreme form, can lead to higher prices for products, it can stifle innovation of new products, and it can even put some small beauty companies that you love out of business. So just for your own education, we want you to learn the truth about regulations in the cosmetic industry. And don't worry, with Perry on board, it won't be a boring discussion. Everybody, and welcome to another scintillating scientific showgram. I'm Randy Schuler, and I'm here with my better half, Perry Romanowski. Yo, Perry.
Hey, that's so nice of you to call me the better half.
I better set that straight. That makes it sound like we're a couple, and that's not what I mean. I mean, I hardly find you attractive at all, so just be clear about that.
Right. Of course. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Right. Harken back to the 1990s.
Seinfeld reference there. I like that.
You know, speaking of things in the media, you know, I write for this other blog called Chemist Corner.
Yeah, the one you do behind my back. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. you think I don't see that, but I do.
Well, Chemist Corner. So it's a fun little blog written for cosmetic formulators. But anyway, I did this one blog post on there where I looked at popular culture, and I tried to find examples of cosmetic chemists.
Oh.
And I put together a few. So there was the Joker, you know, from the Batman movie, when Joker is that evil cosmetic chemist who makes that makeup that kills everyone.
Okay. I'm not going to quibble with you about Joker being a cosmetic chemist, but he did use some drugged makeup, so I'll give you that.
All right, yeah. Then of course, Poison Ivy. I don't know why Batman has all these cosmetic chemists in there.
Yeah, she had a poison lipstick, I believe.
And I think she had the pheromone fragrances. So she was more of a perfumer, I guess.
It kind of reminds me of our book. It's okay to have poison in your lipstick.
as long as it's at a really low amount. But no, I was just made aware of a movie that came out in 2012 called Upside Down, featuring one of my favorite actresses who I fell in love with in her cheerleader movie, Bring It On, Kirsten Dunst.
Oh, God.
You know, I'm a big fan of cheerleader movies. I don't know why, but it's a genre I appreciate. Kirsten Dunst was...
But wait. Isn't she much more famous for playing Mary Jane in the Spider-Man movies?
Oh, yeah, she was in that too. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Cheerleader.
Actually, Spider-Man was a cosmetic chemist,
right? No, he's a polymer chemist. He never made... Oh, stop it. All right, so back to cheerleading.
But it's the movie Upside Down, yeah. Came out in 2012. It was a love story or something. It's a futuristic kind of thing. But the point was that Adam is, in the movie, the character who plays, or the character Adam, is a cosmetic chemist producing facelifts with this new technology. So
you mean he's a plastic surgeon?
No, he's an actual formulator, a chemist, so...
Really?
So, wow. Cosmetic chemists are impinging popular culture. I can't wait. It warms my heart.
I'll have to see that now.
Now, speaking of warming my heart, we have a big show today, right?
Well, are we ready for our first segment? From your enthusiastic response, I'll take that as a yes. So now, everybody, it's time for Beauty Science News. So each week, we bring you the latest news related to beauty science. Today, I thought I'd share an article about the placebo effect in medicine, and then we can talk about how that applies to cosmetics. How does that sound, Perry?
I love the placebo effect and look forward to learning about it.
Well, then you'll certainly enjoy this article that came off of one of NPR's websites.
Oh, I love NPR.
I do as well.
I'm drinking out of my iHeart NPR mug right now. I'm a card-carrying member of WBEZ Chicago. Hey, maybe that'll get us on Science Friday. Come on.
Or This American Life. I'd settle for that.
This American.
So anyway,
Radiolab.
Oh, I love Radiolab.
Sorry.
All right. Yeah. Well, the article in question is titled "Half of a Drug's Power Comes from Thinking It Will Work." So, as always, I'll put a link to the article in the show notes so our listeners can check it out for themselves. But essentially, the article says that in this pain medication study, the author found that, and I'm quoting here, basically we show that words can actually double the effect of a drug, which is pretty crazy if you think about it. So let me just quickly review what they tested and what they found. So they did, I think they had six different test cells here, and these were people who experienced migraines. So one group, they gave no treatment whatsoever. And for those people, they experienced a 15% increase in pain, which makes sense. They're not taking anything at all and it could get worse. Then they had a group that got a known placebo. So they said to the people, this is fake. This is just a fake empty pill. Here, take this. 26% of the people had a decrease in pain from that.
Wow.
Then they had a placebo, but it was labeled as the drug. So people thought it was the drug, even though it did nothing at all. Those people also had about a 25% decrease in pain. Then they took the actual drug that is proven to work, but they said it was fake. Those people had a 36% decrease in pain. And then they said, here's just a pill, take it. They didn't tell people what it was at all. They had a 40% decrease. And then when they gave people the actual drug and said, this is the real drug, they also had a 40% decrease in pain. So it's amazing, like, just, you know, just how you label the pill had a pretty strong impact on people's perception of pain reduction. So, it got me thinking, you know, what does this mean for cosmetics? If the power of words is so great when it comes to a drug, at least in terms of, you know, the self-perception of pain, what could that mean for cosmetic products?
Well, that reminds me of the halo effect. And this is the effect that when people try something, they are influenced by things like the packaging, the color, the fragrance, and the story of the formula more than the way that the formula works.
You know, that I'm reminded of a comment from a couple of episodes before. It was the show we did about the skin soothing product. Remember Gail's question about her Howdy Doody lines?
Right.
Remember that was the show we got into the argument about what that really meant?
I remember the big controversy, yeah.
You know, I thought for sure Gail would write in and tell us sort of which one of us was right about how we interpret it, but we never heard from her.
Oh, she did, and she said I was
You're
right.
A liar. So anyway, my point is, after we analyzed the product that she liked, and we talked about the ingredients that might actually contribute to skin soothing, you raised a point, and you said, you know, it might just be because she likes the product, and it just works because she believes in it. And that's, you know, that's exactly what happened here in this pain reliever study.
Yeah, exactly. And it's fascinating that that happens with drugs, and the same sort of thing happens with cosmetics. Now, the one thing I want to point out in that drug study, they talked about more of the effect on, like, symptoms, right?
Correct.
And so placebos, while they work on symptoms like, you know, head pain, right, and, I don't know, diarrhea or those sorts of things, they don't really work for treating the actual disease.
Hmm.
Like, you couldn't get a placebo effect that would shrink cancer, for example.
Okay.
But in the cosmetic realm, the placebo effect is strong. And it's the thing, I think, that I call it placebo effect or the halo effect. I think they're kind of the same phenomenon.
Certainly related, yeah.
But it's the kind of thing that makes people spend more money on cosmetics than maybe they need.
Yeah, just believing a more expensive product works better than, you know, and then you buy the more expensive product, you've invested your time and money into it, so you're more inclined to believe it works. The other thing this reminds me of, and again, we might have mentioned this in a previous show, I don't remember, but remember the experiments we did with hair care products where you could take a single batch of a conditioner, for example, and split that in half and fragrance it two different ways and then give it to people to try and then ask them to rate how their hair feels afterwards. And you know, people will rate the product very differently for conditioning attributes just because it smells different. And the fragrance has no effect whatsoever on how well it conditions. But people believe it, you know, detangles better, makes their hair shinier and smoother, and what have you, just because of the smell.
Yeah, it's what makes consumer research so difficult and makes me so completely skeptical of anything that comes out of consumer research, is because people are so easily influenced by factors which are not related to the questions they're being asked. In fact, when I think of like consumer research, the only thing that I have confidence in is if someone says, do you like it or not?
Yeah.
Then I have confidence in that answer. But when you ask answers about why do you like it, I lose a lot of confidence in, because people are easily fooled by things like the placebo effect or the halo effect.
Yeah, there's the example in household cleaning products where they've shown that a lemon scent makes people believe the product cleans better than a rose scent or a floral scent. So just that one little change, you know, subconsciously, I guess, affects performance.
And that's also culturally influenced, too. Maybe other countries in the world outside the U.S., that lemon scent does not necessarily denote clean. Maybe there's another scent. I think I've heard that lavender is more of a cleansing scent in other places around
the world. No, that's a good point. There's a cultural halo effect, I guess, as well. So anyway, it's sort of, you know, sort of like mind over matter, I guess.
Right. And it's also the thing is, when you're purchasing cosmetics or you're looking for personal care products, just realize that a lot of the effect, when you think something is working really well, you know, some of that could be a placebo or a halo effect, and when you buy a cheap cosmetic, you might think it's not working as well because you know how much it costs and you can't imagine it does. In fact, it might be working perfectly fine.
You know, I think you just described another good trick for someone's skeptical toolbox.
Yeah, and these are the types of things that you can find in our latest book. It's okay to have lead in your lipstick.
And answers to other beauty questions you're dying to know.
Speaking of beauty questions, we had somebody send one in, right?
Yes, we've got another listener question today, and this one is from Sarah, and she's asking about regulations in the cosmetic industry. So let's hear what Sarah wants to know.
Oh, hi. This is Sarah. I have a friend who's a Jane Iredale rep, and she is convinced that most other brands besides Jane Iredale are not safe and are not suitable for sensitive skin. She has said about the cosmetics industry that it's an unregulated industry, and anyone can put anything in cosmetics. I know that this isn't true, and that the cosmetics industry is in fact regulated by the FDA in the United States, but I don't feel educated enough to back up what I say. So I thought you might be able to help. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sarah, for that question. I'll start by saying that the idea that the cosmetic industry is unregulated and that anybody can put anything in any product is a myth. In fact, there are three levels of regulation to which the cosmetic industry is subjected. There are federal regulations, state regulations, and then self-regulation within the industry. So we'll take a quick look at all of these. Now, remember, we could spend an entire show on any one of these areas. So we'll kind of give you a quick overview and hopefully give you enough ammunition that you can go have a discussion with your friend and give her the straight facts.
But I want to put a caveat that her friend's claim is probably just aimed at the United States, and our discussion is going to be focused mainly on the United States. We should note that over in the EU and Japan and all over the world, there are regulating bodies for cosmetic products, and the regulations are all a little bit different, but they have huge similarities. You can be sure that the products you buy in Europe are going to be every bit as, you know, safe to use as the ones you get here in the United States.
All right, that's fair enough. So let's talk a little about this first level of regulation, the federal level. So there are two main laws that govern cosmetics here in the U.S., and those are the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act and the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act. So, Perry, you want to talk about the FD&C Act?
Well, the FD&C Act was a piece of legislation that was passed. You know when it was passed?
I want to say 1938.
1938. Ah. Nicely done. And at the time, cosmetics were actually, people were actually getting sick from different types of products that they were using. So there was a big push by state governments and then finally the federal government to get some regulations around these. And so they passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, and it has really five key points. First, they prohibit poisonous or deleterious substances to be used, thereby negating that claim that you can put anything in it. You cannot put poisonous or deleterious substances.
So you could almost, we could almost stop right there. I mean, well, right? I mean, if somebody says, well, you can put anything in cosmetics, no, this law, which is still, you know, strongly in effect today, says you can't put things that are dangerous in cosmetics, period. So right there, exactly. Right there, Sarah, that should help.
Right. And then there are other parts. You know, there are specific ingredients, restricted particular ingredients. Now, I don't know why you have to restrict particular ingredients when you have that first point, but this is legal stuff. So there are actually some named ingredients by the FDA that are absolutely not allowed in cosmetics. For example, mercury. You can't put that in cosmetics.
Right.
Then the act mandates claim substantiation. So anything that you say about your product, you just can't lie, right? And yes. Sometimes it seems like cosmetic companies are lying, but if you look at the claims, almost invariably, they're going to have support for the claims that they make. So they do that through by claim substantiation.
Yes, certainly. And finally, certainly it's true of the larger companies. I mean, you may find smaller companies who, you know, fly under the radar and maybe a little more liberal with their claims, but certainly
I like to use the term loosey-goosey.
Is that a legal term?
It is. There is also a significant regulation of color additives. Back at the time when this act was put together, color additives were probably some of the most dangerous compounds that were being put into products, and so the FDA made a list, and every single color additive that is in cosmetics in the United States has to be certified by the federal government. So there's regulation right there. So yeah. It flies in the face of what that claim that it's unregulated goes.
Yeah, there were people back before this act was passed that were being blinded because of the color additives people were using that were truly dangerous. And thankfully, you know, we don't have that happening anymore.
Right, and it's because of this regulation. And then finally, they do require a warning label for coal tar-based hair dyes. So it's interesting that they have like this little, you know, very specific thing. Coal tar-based hair dyes were popular at the time, but they knew that there were some risks associated with it. But I think the industry at the time was able to demonstrate that it can be used safely, and the FDA just requires that if you're going to have a coal tar-based hair dye, you have to put a warning label on there.
Right, because some people do develop allergies to those materials, so a warning, and hopefully, you know, people are actually doing those patch tests that the warning includes, so if they do develop an allergic response, they can safely find out on their, you know, on their arm or something before they slather the stuff all over their head.
Now, one important thing is that the FDA does have a requirement that you can only sell products that are safe. Now, the FDA does not tell you how you can prove that your product is safe. It just requires that you do only sell safe products. And if the FDA at some point determines that the safety of your product is not substantiated, you don't have the proper testing to prove that that's safe, then the product would be labeled as misbranded, and misbranded products are illegal to sell in the United States.
Right.
So you can see this with this FD&C Act, the FDA does have a lot of power to control the cosmetic products.
So that's a hugely important point, and I think it's confusing to people, and I think that statement is taken out of context as well. So the idea that you know, the law does not require companies to safety test their products prior to marketing. You know, if you told somebody that, you know, it's true, but they can easily misunderstand that to mean, oh, well, it's okay to market something that hasn't been tested at all. Like the people in the cosmetic companies are going, woohoo, we can just throw this out the door. Well, that's not true at all.
Right.
Just because you don't have to report prior to testing, prior to marketing a new formula that it has been tested, trust me, Any reputable company is either using combinations of ingredients that have already proven to be safe, or if they are using new ingredients of any sort, then they are doing their own safety testing before going to market just to cover their butts, because the liability of going to market with a product that you know you have no safety data for, whether it's data from, you know, from previous testing or from new testing, that's tremendously dangerous. And no reputable company is going to do that. So I think that law gets, that part of the law gets misquoted and taken out of context, but it certainly does not mean that, that unsafe products are going out on the market.
Right. And the FDA, you know, when people say FDA is powerless to regulate cosmetics, they have some things that they can do. For example, they can prosecute a company or a person, and they can, you know, file criminal charges against the company. Yep. There's also seizure. They can, you know, federal marshals will come in and seize your product. And actually, that happened, I recall, a few years ago to a Jan Marini eyelash.
They were making unsubstantiated or, you know, misbranded claims, I guess, about eyelash growth. And the feds went in and pulled the stuff out of warehouses, I believe.
Yeah. $2 million worth of inventory. Hmm. They can also have an injunction. So that's a civil action that requires you to stop making and distributing the product. So they can file that. And finally, the FDA can force a recall, which would remove all your products from all of the store shelves. And that could cost a lot of money.
That's
so
expensive.
There is a lot that the FDA can do if they find that you are selling a misbranded or illegal cosmetic.
So the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is sort of the big daddy when it comes to legislation. That's what puts most of the muscle in enforcement and keeping these products safe. But there are a number of other pieces of legislation that are worth mentioning. So I said something before about the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act. So that's what mandates what the labels of your cosmetic products must look like. And that includes five things that have to be on any label to be considered legal. The first is product identity. Now, it sounds kind of obvious, but you have to the name has to disclose, you know, what the product is and, in a sense, what it does. And I remember at one point we were marketing, I think it was a new hairspray. And, you know, there are, you know, regulations around the VOC content of hairsprays, which has to do with air pollution. And we thought we were going to be clever. The marketing group thought they were going to be clever. So they weren't going to call it a hairspray. They were going to call it a, you know, hair setting mist or something. I forget. They had some clever term. Well, that product would actually be illegal by under the Fair Packaging and Labeling Act because it didn't have that clear statement of product identity. So you call it a hairspray, then you know you have to follow the hairspray rules. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you have to declare the net contents. So how much of the product is in the package. And this includes provisions against underfilling. So in other words, you cannot sell, you know, a 16-ounce bottle, you know, that looks like a big package and only put 10 ounces in it.
Right.
That is illegal under this act as well. You have to have the name and location of the manufacturer so you can trace back who the product is coming from. You have to have the list of ingredients, which I think everyone's familiar with. And then you have to have warning statements on the package when necessary. So if it's a, you know, product that's you know, flammable, like a hairspray we just talked about, there's a specific warning statement that you have to include. So, so that act is, you know, helping keep everybody safe through those five parameters.
Now, additionally, there are some cosmetic type products that are actually over the counter drugs, and so the FDA, another way that the FDA has jurisdiction is with the OTC products, and these are regulated through what are called monographs, and the monographs tell companies exactly what active ingredients they can use and what levels and the claims that they can make about them. So that's very specifically regulated. Anything OTCs are very specifically regulated.
Yeah, people don't realize that they treat those as cosmetic products, but those legally are drugs under that OTC drug review.
Yeah.
Okay, now there are a couple of other laws which grant some additional oversight, but they're not related just to cosmetics, but certainly worthy of mentioning. There's the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA. Now, that one is under the jurisdiction of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. Now, that controls single ingredients, not finished products. So let's say that the EPA decided that, you know, phthalates, you know, were harmful. So under TSCA, the EPA could outlaw phthalates. Now, they don't have any direct authority over cosmetics, but if the EPA rules that an ingredient is dangerous, you can expect that the FDA would look at it, and then they would likely consider a cosmetic product with that ingredient to be adulterated, and therefore it would fall under their jurisdiction under the FTC Act. So even though right. the EPA doesn't control cosmetics, their laws can impact what the FDA does.
And then, you know, of course, the Federal Trade Commission, they're the ones responsible for, you know, regulating the claims and the advertising that are made. And so it's pretty broad. But, you know, they are designed to prohibit unfair or deceptive ads or practices affecting commerce, which is pretty broad. But basically, the FTC gets involved in whenever you see advertising for a cosmetic. You have to prove that what you say about your product is true. And now they can't go after everyone, so a lot of small companies can get away with saying things that maybe aren't necessarily supportable, which is what you find on the internet. But they do crack down on people, and especially on bigger companies. And so the things you see published by big companies are frequently, they always will have some sort of case on why they're not misleading or untrue.
Right. The FTC may not always agree with them. But
right.
but the large companies will always have some claim support. Right. You know, the a second source of advertising regulation is the NAD, which is the National Advertising Department of the Better Business Bureau. Now, they're actually more likely to challenge cosmetic ads because consumers and competitors can go directly to the NAD and say, hey, you know, I saw this ad and I don't believe this to be true. The NAD, however, doesn't have any direct authority to take action. So what they can do is when they uncover an issue, they would turn that over to the FTC. So if the parties can't agree through some sort of moderation process that, okay, we'll change our ad, then the NAD would take it to the FTC and say, hey, take a look at this. You may need to take some action.
Right. And then one final is the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The CPSC has authority over soap and then any hazards presented by cosmetic containers and then special packaging standards under the Poison Control Act. One of the things I didn't mention about the FD&C Act, the Cosmetic Act that created the category, it does not include soap. Even though soap, by all intents and purposes, would be considered a cosmetic or personal care product. It was grandfathered out of it because presumably at the time the soap people had a very strong lobby.
I know. How ridiculous is that? Like the soap makers were like, we're going to get exempt from this law. And they did.
And they did, yeah. But having said that, when you make a soap that's not, you can't make any cosmetic claims about it. Otherwise, it would be regulated as a cosmetic.
That's a good point. You mentioned you mentioned those packaging standards as well. So like things like childproof caps, for example. And I think my mouthwash, I don't know if it's true of all mouthwashes, but I think if mouthwash has a certain level of alcohol in it, it has to have a childproof cap. So that would be under the jurisdiction of the Consumer Product Safety Commission as an example.
Well, you're still using that Jack Daniels brand mouthwash? That's what you're... you know that's not mouthwash.
I like it anyway. All right. So, okay. So there we have kind of a quick summary of the federal regulations. Now, on top of that, there are state regulations, right? So,
sure.
You know, states are free to pass whatever laws they want to related to cosmetics, as long as they don't conflict with the federal standards. And every state has some regulations that apply both to soap and cosmetics. Now, most of them pretty much just follow the federal regulations, but,
right.
you know, but some do have more extensive requirements. So, I'll put a link in the show notes to a page that lists the regulations for every state, but I'll just give you three quick examples. California, they pioneered legislation which restricts VOCs, which are volatile organic compounds, for cosmetics. So again, in hairsprays, you can only have so much organic material like the alcohol in hairsprays. That's why we had to develop so many water-containing hairsprays when that law came out in the 1990s.
Right.
Florida has a law that requires a cosmetic manufacturer permit for anybody who manufactures or repackages cosmetics. That's not true in all states, but that's the law in Florida. And then thirdly, Maryland outlawed just specific types of phthalates in cosmetics, and not all states have done that. So again, you know, there are dozens, probably hundreds of laws at the state level on top of everything we've talked about at the federal level.
Yeah, and it it remains to be seen whether some of these state regulations will hold up. For example, Minnesota is making they're banning certain preservatives. Now that law doesn't come into effect until next year, but we'll see. I think some of these things will be challenged in court, and ultimately, I think a lot of this stuff will be coming back to the federal regulators.
Yeah, good point.
And then finally, there's self-regulation, right, by the companies.
Yeah, and I'm you know, if somebody's that afraid of the big cosmetic companies, they'll probably poo-poo this idea of self-regulation. You know, it's the fox guarding the hen house, I guess. But it is legitimate, right? So we've got you know, most of the big companies voluntarily will register their manufacturing facilities, the composition of their cosmetic raw materials, their ingredient statements. They have to file what is known as adverse product experiences. So if you make a hair relaxer and somebody burns their scalp using your product, you report those findings to the government. And there's a database that shows, you know, every time somebody's had a bad reaction to a cosmetic. So these voluntary reporting programs, they all help government get access to information to, you know, continue to ensure that these products are safe.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the bottom line is, contrary to what you hear on the internet or misinformed people may tell you, cosmetics are regulated pretty extensively in the United States, and they're regulated on three levels, both the federal, state, and industry self-regulations. And so you might disagree with the level of regulation that's out there or the way that they're enforced, but to say that the industry is unregulated and it's the wild, wild west, that's just not true.
Excellent. Well done. So hopefully, Sarah, that'll help you in your discussion with your Jane Iredale friend. So let us know how that works out for you.
Indeed, indeed. Well, that looks like we've come to the end of the show here.
Yeah, and you know, if you just can't get enough of the program and you want to learn more, you can always pick up a copy of our new book, It's Okay to Have Lead in Your Lipstick.
And answers to other beauty questions you're dying to know.
And you can get that on Amazon.com, at the iBook store. You can go to our website and purchase a hand-autographed paperback copy, which is makes for a good gift.
Hey, you know what else you can get at our website?
What's that?
We have this free newsletter, so free Beauty Brains newsletter.
Hang on. I thought we agreed we weren't going to give any more free stuff away.
Oh no! I know. Well, yeah, I just couldn't help it. After the holidays, and I got all inspired by giving at the holiday season. I got more we want to give, so we have this free newsletter that you can sign up for.
All right, how do you do that?
And actually, if you do sign up for it, you can you get our free report on how to save money on cosmetic products, and you can save over what, $500 a year
if you follow all the instructions. Yeah.
Wow, that's a that's pretty good.
So how do you sign up for this magic newsletter?
Oh, well, then you could just go to our website, thebeautybrains.com, and we have a little tab at the top of the website that says newsletter. Click on that, and then that'll bring up a form, and you just fill in your name and email address, and that's it.
Excellent. Well.
And it's 100% free.
All right. Well, Perry, we've reached the end of another episode, and I got to tell you, you know, I feel like I've kind of been dominating, you know, the catchphrase at the end of every show, and that's not fair to you. So I thought this week, you know what? Why don't you just sign off the show any way you want?
Really?
Yeah, whatever you want.
But I didn't even prepare. I didn't even know.
But you know, be spontaneous. You're good at that. It's
sure,
like, hey,
sure,
everybody, goodbye. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again next week.
Well, I don't even just... Well, I do have this ukulele. Goodbye, everybody, and thanks for listening, and thanks for stopping by. So I guess that's it. Bye.